We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the Papers podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. In this series, we speak to authors of papers published in one of ACAM's three journals. These are the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, commonly known as JCPP, the Child and Adolescent Mental Health, known as CAM, and JCPP Advances. Today I'm interviewing Jonathan Green, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, University of Manchester and Manchester Academic Health Sciences Centre. This podcast coincides with World Autism Awareness Week and will focus on Jonathan's CAM paper, Debate, Neurodiversity, Autism and Healthcare. If you're a fan of our Papers podcast series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Jonathan, welcome. Thank you for joining me. Can you start with an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Hi, Joe. Yes, very good to be here. So I'm a clinical child psychiatrist, as you mentioned, working at the Manchester Children's Hospital. And there I run a clinical service and have done for many years now, focusing on early child social development and particularly autism, and have worked in inpatient settings and specialist outpatient settings, which is more where I'm at now. I'm also a research professor in the university, and I run a research team. And we are particularly interested in the research team in early child social development, early autistic development, intervention development and testing. So I've done a lot of work on early intervention and testing those in rigorous trials. And in the last few years, increasingly worked with the autistic community. And we'll be talking a bit more about this, I think, in the podcast, thinking about autistic experience and how we can co-produce interventions and services with the community.
Fantastic. Thank you. So we're going to focus on your paper. This is Debate, Neurodiversity, Autism and Healthcare, recently published in CAM. The paper opens with the following statement. We are at a time of unparalleled flux in our understanding of what autism is and how to respond to it, including our understanding of the role of clinical services. Jonathan, can you set the scene for us? What is it currently like for CAM professionals working in this field?
I think the experience for CAMS professionals is quite a complex one, which is really why I wrote the paper. So this paper was really primarily addressed to clinician colleagues. But of course, given the current environment, one knows that all papers of this kind are going to be read by a diverse audience. I was thinking about my clinician colleagues, and I think now we're in a phase of CAMS, child mental health, but also pediatric practice of huge interest in autism, huge referral demand. So it's quite extraordinary, actually, that for many CAMS services, up to 70-80% of new referrals at the present time are in relation to neurodiversity and autism. There's a huge preoccupation with this, obviously, in the referring community as well as the clinical one. So there's that. There's an experience for clinicians of huge demand, trying to manage that demand efficiently, often feeling overwhelmed with waiting lists and constantly feeling under pressure and feeling bad for parents who have to wait so long with their children on wait lists, etc. And I think a confusion about what to do. So what is autism anyway, as I say in the paper, and what should we do about it within healthcare? And I think those questions, that which are essentially conceptual ones and practical service provision ones, dominate the experience of clinicians at the moment.
Thank you. We'll dig a bit deeper into the questions you've just raised in a moment. But can you give us a kind of brief overview of the paper? What was the aim?
So the aim is to, as I say, engage clinicians, engage hopefully with their experience and concerns, and to try and present a conceptualization of autism as we currently understand it from the developmental science literature and the intervention literature. So an evidence-based, I hope, conceptualization of autism, as I say in the paper, emergent and transactional, and we'll come back to those terms, I know, in the podcast. So to try and give them a conceptualization of neurodiversity and autism in the current state of things, and also then some suggestions of how what this might imply for how we can develop and apply services. I'm particularly interested and finish the paper off really with this in how we should organize services now better, more efficiently, and more evidence-based. So I end the paper with some proposals for what I call an evidence care pathway for autism in the current state of things. And I hope that, you know, colleagues will come away with perhaps a language, a way of thinking about autism in the current state of things, and some signposts for how they might respond clinically.
I'm sure that would be greatly appreciated. I want to go back to the conceptualization of autism. Can you describe the evolution of the autism concept over time and explain where we are at currently?
Yeah, well, this is a deep and interesting question. The sort of classical sense we have of autism as an entity, really, I would say clinically pretty stable since the 1940s, when we had the descriptions from Leo Kanner classically and others of this entity called childhood autism. Really, from the 60s and 70s, this notion of autism got codified into what was called at the time, what we still call really a behavioral phenotype. And what this meant was that particularly the clinical scientists at the time wanted to try and work out a way of investigating autism systematically and scientifically and epidemiologically. And they developed a notion of measuring behavior. They felt that they couldn't really approach autism in any other way than observing behavior at the time. And indeed, this was successful and developed a really consistent, coherent, and reproducible sense of what we call the behavioral phenotype of autism based on observed behaviors, mainly in children. So adults were not so much considered at this time, which has changed. And this so-called behavioral phenotype really defined what people thought about as autism and what clinicians came to understand as autism as well. And we can see this now in historical evolution, and it was encodified into the DSM and the ICD iterations of those nosologies into really 50, 60 years of clinical science development and investigation. And I think behind that, at the beginning, was a rather typical biomedical kind of approach to say, okay, here's an entity, we define it by this behavioral phenotype, let's look for the cause of it, so-called biomarkers and original causes. And these were particularly focused on genetics and on brain science. And so the search was on for particular genes. When I was first involved at the beginning of my career in early genetic studies, there were the notion there would probably be five or six main genes that would explain this entity, and that we would be able to find some key neurodevelopmental signatures in what was called at the time the social brain, the sort of areas of the brain that might be affected to explain why autism development happened. So this was a dominant paradigm for a long time. And I think what's changed, and I mention in the paper this sense of a paradigm shift, and I do believe that that is happening at the moment for a number of reasons. One is that that scientific project has evolved into increasing complexity. So the idea that we were going to find a single cause, genetic or other, has really disappeared on the horizon. We're into a much more complex landscape of what we call now neurodiversity or distributed autistic traits. And on the other hand, simple neurodevelopmental brain biomarkers, so-called, have not been realized. We haven't found them. What we found instead, through some lovely studies, some of which I've been involved in myself, research-wise, have been a number of different subtle differences all across brain functioning and psychological developmental functioning. So it's like a whole diffuse set of differences. And from a genetic point of view, we know that there are several hundred now genes of small effect that contribute to autistic development, except for that minority of single gene cases, which are real and important, but they're not the majority of what we think of as autism in the community. Our concept of autism now is, and that's partly my what I'm addressing in the paper, is how we can still understand autism as an entity against this background of diversity and diffusion. We've got a if you want, in sort of technical terms, sort of dispersed traits across the population without particular simple boundaries between autistic trait variation and as it were, normal distribution. So they fade into each other when you look at it at a trait level. And yet we still recognize an autism entity. And this contrast between an entity that we realize against a background of distributed traits that we understand as highly heritable, understandable within neurodevelopment, that contrast between distributed traits and an entity is what I tackle in the paper by calling autism emergent within development. And the concept of emergence is used in order to try and bridge this conceptual paradox between the dimensional trait version and the categorical entity version of autism. The innovation in the idea of autism that I'm putting forward in the paper is that autism, for a long period in its conceptual evolution, was thought of as basically genetically determined, particularly in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, that it was highly heritable, and we know that's true at a mm-hmm. family level, and that actually autism would just develop in child development as a process of genetic unfolding. So it's highly intrinsic to the child. The different, and I'm not contradicting that at all, that happens. But what I'm adding to it is a more modern notion of what I call the transactional environment within which the neurodiverse child develops. In other words, a baby who's born neurodiverse experiences the world just like any baby does, both in physical terms and in interpersonal terms. And the way that they experience the world early on also has an effect on autism emergence. You know, autism as an entity emerges the first few years of life. You can see it as a baby. It's like something that comes early in development. And the question has always been, what's the antecedent to that? What are the developmental processes? And I'm suggesting there are transactional processes between the young child and the environment that contribute to autism emergence. The reason I say that is that it's not just a sort of theory. It's based on the fact that when we do clinical trials of interventions into the early environment around the neurodiverse child, and we succeed in altering that early environment, we do alter the way autism emerges. In other words, the logical inference from that is that the autism concept is at least in partly determined by environmental experience. It's to some extent malleable, not completely, but to some extent that emergence is malleable depending on environmental transactions. And that idea of autism as emergent early on out of the complexity of distributed trait variation. And the idea of emergence really is that it's more than the sum of its parts. Autism emerges as an entity, a recognizable entity. It can't be reduced to its component parts successfully. And part of those parts is the transactional experience in the environment. So I think of autism in that sense as both emergent and transactional.
Thank you. You very comprehensively have described the paradigm shift that has occurred over the decades. It sounds like we haven't quite landed yet, and you talk about profound changes are afoot. Can you elaborate on what you anticipate when you talk about profound changes?
To some extent, they relate to what I've just described in terms mm-hmm. of some paradoxes that have emerged in the science investigation over the last 50, 60 years. But also in parallel in the last 10, 15 years, has been a rise in awareness from the clinical and science community of the neurodiversity movement and autistic advocacy. And this has been a powerful phenomenon, which has given us a new perspective on the experience of autistic people. Their basic autistic people have found their voice about what it's like to be autistic and their opinions on how those people, those advocates or the community wish to be treated. And alongside that has been a real expansion in the concept of what autism might be. So we have another paradox here, which is the core entity, or core prototypical entity that we sort of recognize clinically. And yet what we call autism has gradually expanded as we've expanded the description. And as autistic people talk about their experience, those experiences are quite diverse and expand the concept still further. And this has led to a bit of a crisis, if you like, in the conceptualization of what autism is, which we need to have a language to try and explain. So these are some of the factors. They're social, in terms of the autism advocacy from the community who wish to be understood and treated often differently. And they don't want to be talked about. They want to be talked with. They don't want to be treated on. They want to be supported with, as it were. So a much more participatory approach that they're... And of course, this is happening across medicine, but it's particularly pointed here. And so we have this combination of the scientific paradigm that is, as it were, under internal, I would say, internal stress. And often those are moments when science comes up with new innovations. And I think we are in one of those exciting periods now, alongside of which the neurodiversity and autism community gives us an extra dimension to think about as we go forward.
So just to sort of summarise, so we have autism as a clinical concept, autism as an administrative term used as a gateway to access services, and autism as self-identification, which advocates for a depathologized concept of autism. So can these different realities coexist? And I want to quote something from your paper, because your paper talks of the risk of fragmentation and the loss of a common language, which you referred to just before. Why does this matter? Why does it matter to have a common language?
It is characteristic, of course, of the current time that there is vigorous debate, but also often oppositional debate and divisions and position taking. We're all familiar with the culture wars and the kind of the sense of positions being taken and divisiveness. And this has certainly affected some of the discussion around autism in recent years. Does this matter? Well, I think it really does matter a lot. You know, we are having, as clinicians, to sort of rethink our relationship to what we thought of as autism and autistic people. And you're right to say that a lot of the autistic community argue for what they call a depathologized autism. In other words, autism as an idea or concept shouldn't be thought of as a disorder. And yet in our clinics, the kind of children and families who come to us are in great distress, are really struggling often. And, you know, any clinician who's worked in services with autism knows the real stress and distress and disability that can occur in our clinical cohorts. The danger is that the clinical reality that we see gets divorced from this notion of a depathologized autism. And there's an issue of healthcare legitimacy here, which is that a lot of the autistic community have argued that because they want to argue for a depathologized autism, that means that we shouldn't be treating autism. And there's been a lot of argument focused on whether treatment should happen at all. And this relates to all sorts of other issues around eugenics and a sense of trying to do away with autism. So that is some of the concern from the community has been that you're trying to do away with us. And so we have as clinicians to hear that, listen to it, really respect that view, but also be aware of our own clinical realities and say, okay, so how do we conceptualize what clinical service provision and intervention is in the current day with autism? And for that, I think we do need a common language, a clinical language with which we can understand what autism is and how to talk with autistic people, colleagues, in a unified way. Otherwise, we just end up being siloed. Clinicians who do this, but actually no one trusts us, or at least a lot of the community don't trust us, don't think what we're doing is legitimate. That is an unsustainable situation for a healthcare system, in my view. I think we need a participatory approach, one where we co-construct it with our users and our colleagues and the community around us, and that we need a common language across culture as well as healthcare to make sense of this thing we call autism. That's the challenge at the moment. And I think there are a lot of forces, as it were, pushing us apart. And part of my article is to try and find a common concept and language to help bridge that.
We're going to move on in a moment to the way that you've set out your framework for this. But before we go there, I just want to know where intellectual disability and language impairment, how do they tie in with this debate?
Yes, they tie in importantly, because over the last, 20, 30 years, the basic science, the epidemiology, the clinical science has disaggregated, has taken apart intellectual disability and autism per se. So it used to be, when I first came into the field personally, these things were very interlinked, and part of the definition of autism related to delayed developmental milestones of various kinds. The science since then has basically contradicted that idea, because we can find autism, recognizable autism, across the spectrum, the range of intellectual ability and disability. We can find people with extreme cognitive abilities and, superior, if you like, skills cognitively who are autistic. So autism and intellectual disability have been disaggregated. They often co-occur in our, certainly, especially in our clinical samples, but they're fundamentally rather different in concept. And this has been, and language development is rather similar. So language development strongly correlates with intellectual disability. In other words, developmental delay and language delay really go hand in hand often. And language ability delay in itself has also been disaggregated from autism. In other words, one can have autism with extremely good language skills or no language skills at all. So these are separate kind of entities now in our understanding. And this has been a real evolution in our concept of what autism is. What it means is that we need to have clear in our mind what relates to autism and what relates to intellectual disability and language disability. Mm-hmm. And as long as we keep those concepts clear, both clinically and conceptually, then the whole thing becomes much easier to make sense of, in my view. One of the contributory issues here is that intellectual disability per se has not received nearly enough science, clinical science research attention, comparatively with other things. And that needs redressing, so that we don't understand enough about intellectual disability across all its forms. But in clinical practice, we have to work with that and also with autism, but not confuse the two.
Thank you. So, Jonathan, in your paper, you set out a way forward in which you lay out a coherent and evidence-based framework for autism. Can you describe this for us?
Yes, so it partly goes back to what I was saying earlier. We understand now that we have a landscape, if you like, of what we call distributed traits within what I think of as the tradition of individual difference psychology. And that's a long tradition that goes back to the 50s and 60s of recognizing what, in a sense, is the obvious thing, but really taking it seriously, which is that babies, children, are born different. You know, they have different characteristics, different brains, different bodies, and then as they grow, different minds. And this individual difference psychology is more than just a sort of cliche form of words. It's a profound understanding of the important fundamental differences across biology, across psychology in development, and taking that seriously when we come to think about our theorizing. So within individual difference psychology, what I'm advocating is the fact that we see autistic or neurodiversity difference as part of that individual difference landscape. That's fundamentally on the one hand. And as with individual difference psychology across a lot of different phenomena, this is inherently non-pathological. This is biological difference. So we're saying there's a distributed trait landscape of neurodiverse difference that's inherently non-pathological. I'm saying that, however, this neurodiverse landscape includes neurodevelopmental differences that are profound. it's not that I'm trivializing this. Some of these differences are very significant and do completely shape how development progresses. But I'm saying that within this notion of neurodiverse infant development, these babies experience the world differently. And they have this notion of transactional interaction. In other words, one person influences the other person influences that person. It's a transaction both ways. And one understands that in terms of a neurodiverse baby child's transaction with the environment around them, particularly the interpersonal environment. And because autism is so fundamentally social in its manifestations, this interpersonal environment is particularly important. So the neurodiverse child, who, by the way, experiences the neurodiversity most likely fundamentally in non-social terms. These are what we call in the sensorium, the experience of the sensory world, space and time, how time flows, the ways attention flows from one way or another. These are the kinds of experiences that are really fundamental to autistic experience. They actually have a big difference on the way that the autistic child experiences the environment. And it's out of that that grows, emerges autistic states or recognizable autism in the first few years of life. And that transaction between the neurodiverse child and the environment is the transactional aspect. So I'm talking about autism as emergent from the background of neurodiversity and transactional with the environment. And we still then have an autistic entity, which we have to define. It's got fuzzy borders. It's never been easy to totally define yes, no. But we think we know it when we see it. But there's another aspect to it, which I come to in the paper, which is now the experience of the autistic person needs to be incorporated into it. So we have this neurodiverse background, the emergence of autism on transactions with the environment, but also on evolving neurological and neurodevelopment. And then we have an autistic state. So it's trying to understand the entity of autism as emergent against this background, a non-pathological background. Mm-hmm. And we understand that neurodiversity does make many children, not all, but many children vulnerable to mental health conditions and to developmental struggles. And it's those mental health conditions and developmental struggles that the healthcare service needs to address and support. And the kind of intervention that I propose, that we'll come on to in a minute, is what does that. And so I'm proposing a way of understanding intervention which doesn't treat autism in the sense of trying to take it away, but supports it in the sense of neurodiversity towards optimal outcomes and autistic flourishing, as we say.
So with this recasting of autism as emergent and transactional, what are the implications for CAM professionals and other stakeholders?
I think firstly, it helps us conceptually bridge this quotes pathology, quotes non-pathology contradiction. We don't have to think of all neurodiversity or autism as quotes pathological. There are many autistic people who don't need or want clinical services. And of course, one respects that. As clinicians, we need to understand that autism is not necessarily pathological, in quotes. However, we also, of course, understand that autistic children, autistic adults often do need services. They are vulnerable often, and they have a lot of associated difficulties, and their autism itself needs support. So that's one thing. Then we can think, well, okay, so what can we usefully, legitimately, ethically do as clinicians in partnership with the autistic community so that we have mutual trust and understanding? And you know, what I've proposed, certainly focusing on the childhood end, which is my particular specialty, what I've proposed is that we understand this neurodivergence as individual difference. We look for evidence-based practice that can best support the individual difference towards optimal outcomes. And that comes to the intervention development that I've done and tested. So what we've done in these interventions is we basically focus on optimizing the interpersonal environment around the neurodiverse child by just working with the parents initially. And this is a real difference from traditional autism treatments that had specialists working directly with children, usually doing behavioral modification type therapies to try and remove their autistic behaviors and make them more normalized. And that kind of behavioral approach has received a lot of criticism from the autistic community, so ABA and things like that. And personally, I think that that's justified in lots of ways. I don't think that that is a paradigm that really can be legitimized for core autism at this time, but maybe I can nuance that. So what we do is we work just with the parents to help them both recognize and understand their neurodiverse child's communication. And by understanding it and recognizing and being able to attend to the communication of the child, what they find is that then they're able to relate to the neurodiversity more effectively, to respond more effectively to their child. And these things sort of happen automatically in a way. It's the attending to and the understanding and the awareness that we help the parents develop through video feedback. And this is the key of our therapy approach, which is quite unique to it in lots of ways, that we work using this video feedback mechanism with parents to help them understand their child in relation to them. So we basically show the parents videotapes of them interacting with their own child, and the parent explores these videos and helps them understand their child's interactions and intent in communication. So once we do that, what we find in the research, in the trials, is that once the parent becomes more responsive and accurate in their responses to the child, something magical starts to happen, which is that the child automatically, as it were, spontaneously responds by initiating social interaction themselves. They're doing this autonomously. No one's forcing them to do it. They just are drawn to interact more. So what we do is work with the parent's responsiveness, but as that improves, the child's social engagement improves as a consequence. And we've shown that this is a general phenomenon that we see over the trials that we do. It's very repeatable. And as the child engages more spontaneously with the parent, what they're doing is engaging in an environment, an opportunity for social learning and developmental learning with their caregiver in a very normal way, in the way all babies do. So what we're helping really is helping the neurodiverse child engage in those learning experiences, which are, if you want, the birthright of all children. You know, that all children benefit from this. And what we then see going downstream when we follow these children in their development is that they generalize this kind of improvement in social engagement with the parent. They generalize that out into social engagement and other adaptation and phenomena with other people in the world. So they are actually more socially aware and engaged with others outside the family. And also what we show is that they seem less stressed. If we measure stress by the amount of stimming and stereotypies, and it's not that these go away. These are something that are often very intrinsic to neurodiverse development, and we don't try and get rid of them. But what we show is they're often arousal and tension related. They're worse if the child is stressed. What we see is that they reduce behaviorally. This, we think, reflects the fact the child is less stressed. They feel more at home in the world, more at ease in their skin, and more engaged with the reality around them, and more feeling more accepted and more integrated. Those kinds of experiences we think they have from this. And there are a lot of benefits from it. And when we measure what's called the behavioral phenotype of autism as a result, that actually changes. So we're changing that expression of the autistic phenotype. We're not getting rid of autism or neurodiversity, but we're changing that expression by improving what we call social competences, social engagement, social communication, and reducing stress. And that has the consequence of changing what we see as, quotes, autistic behavior. Now, this has been misunderstood as we're changing autism. And the answer is we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're improving social abilities, the sort of sense of comfortableness, and reducing stress. And what we see, which is pretty extraordinary actually, is when we do this in the family setting, that the benefits of that continue for years after the end of therapy. So we've done the longest formal follow-up we've done is for 6 years after the end of therapy. And what we see is these improvements, these benefits for the child's development are sustained over the next 6 years, which for what we call psychosocial intervention is a remarkable result. That, if, to me, then, from that evidence, is a paradigm for me, or a model for how we should put in healthcare support for neurodiversity and families who have a child who's neurodiverse. And if we can put this in at the earliest stages, we think that does the families good. It empowers parents. It signposts them. It helps them to feel competent as parents and more in touch with their child, which is a key issue. They feel engaged and they feel, I've got my child back, or I've got my child for the first time, is often what they say. And they're probably sustained because this is embedded in family life, so that it's sort of 24/7. Once the parents get the hang of this, the child's getting that all the time, and that continues after the end of therapy. So we think that's ideal. I think it's neurodiverse aware and respectful of the neurodiverse community, and does what we want it to do within the healthcare system. There are other things we need to do within CAM's response to autism. There are many autistic kids, as they get older, develop anxiety, depression, other co-occurring mental health conditions, and those need to be treated in their own right with interventions that are themselves autism aware and ideally co-produced with autistic people to make them as effective as possible. So we need to do all that.
It's so helpful. So are there any further recommendations that emerge from your paper or anything else that you would like to highlight?
Like anything, there's no magic bullet here. I think one of the big things for services are, as I mentioned right at the beginning, wait times. So that's one issue. And one thing that we've proposed is that if we take this kind of support model of care, if I could put it like that, early on in a way that we call preemptive, in other words, as early as the child is identified with neurodiversity or concerns about autism development, that if we can put this preemptive support in, that's the most likely to be developmentally effective. And so this is about a redesign of services, really, which at the moment are very reactive. They're kind of firefighting. They're overwhelmed. We think that by redesigning services like this into what I've called the detection care pathway, so that we have ways of detecting early neurodiversity, and then we immediately link that, then this can be pre-diagnosis, but we link that with this early support model that I've suggested. When you have that kind of early detection care, you should be able to reduce wait times and wait lists. And we've actually shown empirically, as we've done this in Manchester, that we do reduce the number of kids on the wait list, and we reduce the amount of time they spend on the wait list. The second thing I'd point to is that education is really key to the whole of any child's experience, and the whole SEND issue, special educational needs, and how we gatekeep into that is a real issue. So at the moment, autism diagnosis, as you mentioned yourself, is used as a gateway label. And this may or may not be really useful for the future. And I think there have to be some redesigned ways of special needs support within communities and schools. That takes us a bit beyond this conversation, but I do think there needs to be a redesign based on something that's more efficient and less based on a diagnosis, which in the end it seems in the current system to be inefficient, and because children are waiting for years for a diagnosis, which and that's hopeless because their needs are not being met. The last one would be, and this is going to be coming, is that a more interest in autistic experience, what we call phenomenology, but perhaps we'll come to that.
Thank you. And Jonathan, is there anything else in the pipeline that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, so that comes really to what I've just said, which is that I think I am certainly myself, and I think the field will move this way, I predict, is a greater interest in autistic experience, what we call phenomenology. Because autism is unusual in developmental mental health conditions in not having subjective experience as part of its conceptualization. Right at the beginning, I talked about this behavioral phenotype, where people made the decision, we're just going to look at behavior, observed behavior, which was successful in its own terms, but we now start to feel rather partial, and that what we need to is redress a balance and think more about autistic experience, phenomenology. It may give us a lot of insights into how to understand autism better and what scientific areas of investigation may be good. And of course, for autistic adults, their experience is really important. And we need to have a better way of understanding and conceptualizing that. So one of the things I'm doing at the moment is really trying to think about how we could systematically get some evidence about what autistic experience actually is across the diversity of autism. And we're planning a project to really look at that at the moment. That's one of the key things I'm looking at.
Great. And finally, Jonathan, what is your take-home message for our listeners?
Clearly, there's a diverse listenership for this, and the messages will be perhaps different for different groups. But I think for clinicians who I did, want to engage with this paper, I hope this gives a way of conceptualizing autistic development that makes sense of the current environment to some degree and has implications for the way services are organized. I think if there was one clinical message I'd want to get across is that we have to make our autistic services in CAMHS and in pediatrics more evidenced, because at the moment they're just a hodgepodge of largely unevidenced reactions of the system, well-meaning and often skilled, but really they haven't been tested and evidenced properly. And that's really a serious problem for such an important condition. So a redesign of services to be preemptive and evidence-based would be my key message to help us develop an evidence-based pathway. And the other big message for clinicians is we need to co-produce our services. And, many clinicians are totally on board with this, but I think we need to be working with autistic community, with autistic people that we know, and with parents of autistic children, all the stakeholders, to co-design our services well, but within an evidenced and I would say preemptive pathway. Let's start on the right foot from really early on. And then I think a lot of things will become much easier, clearer, and you'll have a lot of much happier families.
Wonderful. Jonathan, thank you so much. It's been absolutely fascinating. For more details on Professor Jonathan Green, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.